All right, so here's the thing. I was going to start this week's episode by telling you all about the travel that I have been engaged in over the last month and begging your forgiveness for not having done a podcast. Though I do have a good excuse. I have been pretty much nonstop on the road. But we don't have time because this week's episode is a pop-up episode. None of the usual shenanigans, no ritualistic murder of Luther Abel at the beginning, no agonizing George Martin style over the production. Instead, a good old-fashioned throwdown argument provoked by recent events. Those events being the debate that Noah Rothman, Michael Brendan Doherty, and I had on the most recent episode of The Editors, which was published 2 days ago, and that was curtailed for time. The Editors is more, what's the word? Organized, planned, regimented than this podcast, and we simply ran out of time in the second block. And so just when the boxing gloves were coming off, the debate was shut down. So I thought, having read through some of the responses on Twitter that effectively said, I was watching that, that we could continue it on this podcast on which there is no effective time limit. So today, that is exactly what we are going to do. I am hosting Michael Brendan Doherty and Noah, and we're going to debate Ukraine funding, in fact, the Ukraine war more generally, as we did on The Editors. If you want to go back first and listen to The Editors from 2 days ago, do that now. If you don't know what The Editors is, it's National Review's flagship podcast. It's called The Editors, easy to find. The most recent episode was published on Tuesday. If you don't want to do that, then once I have introduced our sponsor and you hear the bell, you can dive right into it. But before that, I want to tell you about our friends from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, who have all new episodes of their breakout Free the Economy podcast to share. If you're not already listening to that show, which you should be, Free the Economy is a weekly podcast hosted by Richard Morrison that explores opportunities for financial success and self-fulfillment in a world with less government control. Each episode, host Richard Morrison offers news and analysis on the economy and fascinating conversations with experts on topics ranging from the future of artificial intelligence to the perils of a central bank digital currency. Think of the podcast as big ideas meets real-world application in ways that makes our economy happier, healthier, and wealthier. So check out Free the Economy wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CEI.org, Free the Economy. That's CEI.org, Free the Economy. All right, let's start from the beginning. Let's assume that no one listening also listens to The Editors and therefore does not know the views that each of us holds. And given that we have the time to do so, let's approach this from the front rather than edging into it sideways via a debate about congressional appropriations as we did the other day. I'm going to start, Michael, with you. I'm going to give you the floor so that you can set up your view on American funding for and non-kinetic military support for Ukraine. What is your view?
Okay. I have been for the past decade against increasing U.S. involvement in Ukraine in what I see as a broader project between, you know, the United States, the EU, and Ukrainian nationalists to pull Ukraine toward the West economically and as a matter of its security alignment in the world. That is the background in what I believe has been precipitated this crisis. So what I mean is that in Bucharest in 2007, unable to effect immediate Ukrainian membership into NATO, George W. Bush merely promised that someday this will happen. And I think that put a clock on Russia to take extraordinary action to stop this. Because, of course, if Ukraine is in NATO, by definition, it would have to close Russia's naval base at Sevastopol in Crimea. The lease would be, it would be totally nonsensical to have a member of an anti-Russian military alliance with a giant Russian naval asset in it. So I believe that sort of precipitated the crisis. I believe Ukraine's drift to the West is totally understandable. It's totally legible. The West offers more prosperity, less coercion than what Ukraine has had to deal with in the post-Cold War world from Russia. It's a perfectly understandable aspiration. It is also a product of, I would say, and this has also informed my views, is a product of Russia's declining soft power. A Russia that has been unable to affect diplomatically and economically the outcomes it wants in Ukraine is one that is weakening over time. And so it has resorted to strategies of compellence, whether compelling by, you know, rougher coercive diplomacy at first, and then military intervention in Crimea, and then eventually the invasion of 2022. So that is my kind of background view of it. My view of U.S. involvement is that Ukraine is, by definition, almost peripheral to core U.S. interests, economic and security-wise. It is not essential to our security. We were perfectly safe for most of the post-World War II order while it was under the boot of the Soviets. You know, we were not in imminent danger because the Kremlin had undue influence over Kiev. Our prosperity does not run through there. And the American people themselves sense this. We don't do much trade with Ukraine. We've never had much historic intercourse with them. And so there is a kind of hard limit on what Americans are willing to do to back up Ukraine. You know, there you see polls overwhelmingly are against involving the U.S. military directly. I believe that limits the outcomes we can hope to affect in Ukraine severely. I believe Ukraine is a very dear and direct vital interest to Russia because of its naval access to the Black Sea. Because, you know, as Brzezinski and others have pointed out, Russia without Ukraine is basically a rump state. Russia with Ukraine is verging on being an imperial power. And that it's Russia's advantages in geography, in the internal dissension in Ukrainian politics, in its, you know, arguably irredentist claims on Crimea and existing resources make it very easy for Russia to disrupt the project of financially, economically, and politically detaching Ukraine from Russia and integrating it into the West. I believe that project is almost utopian or lunatic in scope, given that we haven't managed to detach Hungary from Soviet-era infrastructure, even though it's been in the EU for decades. The lift in Ukraine is much more treacherous, and that's why Russia has been willing to invest more and sacrifice more, and why I believe it is far more likely to come out on top. And I believe that the more we invest in it, the more likely we are to be humiliated and that instead of enhancing NATO's prestige, we will diminish it, and we will have the second NATO-trained army after Afghanistan collapse in the face of challenge. I think that lowers American prestige, and it does so for very little gain. I believe Ukraine is totally at its, is totally just in resisting Russian compellents. But I don't believe the justness of their cause obliges everyone else to give them military aid.
Okay, so before I get to Noah and allow him to do the same thing, I want to be very careful here, Michael. This is not me putting words in your mouth. I'm trying to give you the opportunity to explain why this characterization is false. But to me, what you just said at the beginning, before you went into why you believe Russia is likely to prevail, sounds a little bit like you arguing that we provoked Russia into invading Ukraine. Why are you not saying that?
Well, I think Russia's invasion in 2022 was certainly a war of choice. I believe our actions may be provocative, but I think it's wrong to blame America for what I do think is a disastrous decision by Putin, disastrous for Russia in the medium term, even if I think Russia is likely to prevail in some of its military aims in the short term. I think people went in with the best of intentions, of course. But
who's people?
Policymakers that wanted to unite, you know, the aspirations of Ukrainians' most nationalist parties with the, you know, Western institutions. Like as I said, I think that's a totally understandable aspiration for Ukrainians who feel nothing but resentment towards the Kremlin and towards Russia itself. I do think, and this is something I'm sure we're going to get into later, because it's part of a kind of supporting argument, is that I also think that it's treacherous to incorporate Ukraine into the Western or liberal world order, partially because Ukraine's Western tilt is dependent on its turn towards illiberalism. That is, it has had to illiberally suppress political parties, movements, possibly even now a church, in its effort at, you know, Ukrainization and de-Russification. I think those efforts are unjust on a human level, even if I understand why nationalists pursue them. I understand all too well, given my background in Irish nationalism. But I don't think that's a project that the U.S. should involve itself in. Again, that's up to the Ukrainians to decide what kind of cultural policies they want to have. But I find it totally contradictory to bring Ukraine in so long as its Western tilt is supported only by this form of repression. It defeats the purpose of the liberal world order, and it corrupts it to some degree.
Okay, so from my perspective, that's an entirely contradictory view, which amounts to, we shouldn't have provoked them, but it's not our fault Russia went in. We shouldn't fund them because we'll lose, but it was a disaster for Russia to start the fight. It's not in our interest, but with Ukraine, Russia becomes a lot more powerful than it would otherwise be.
I don't understand why. What is your trouble grokking the tragedies of history, that things can be bad on for both sides in the long run?
Well, you go on to say that it's not in our interest to fight this, but the likelihood is that Russia will win because they want it more, because if they win, then Russia becomes a lot more powerful than it would be without Ukraine. But then we have a big power sitting next to Poland, which is a NATO member and has been for decades.
Well, this gets into the supporting assumptions. Is I do not believe, I've never believed Russia has sent enough troops to swallow and pacify the whole of Ukraine. I know they sent a serious mission towards Kiev. I do believe they thought the government would collapse. Many people, many Western intelligence agencies thought the government would collapse. And I think a decapitation strike would have been what they wanted. A decapitation effort on the Ukrainian government would assist them in their war aims of liberating, and according to their logic, these oblasts that the Duma arrogated to the Russian territory.
But so what is the argument there? Is it that we shouldn't have helped in the way that we have because Russia can't win, or we shouldn't have helped in the way that we have because Russia is obviously going to win because it wants it more?
Well, defining winning, I mean, I believe Russia's very likely to achieve its territorial ambitions. I think it's very unlikely at this point to achieve its political goal of quote-unquote denazifying the Ukrainian regime, that is, removing the government in Kiev and replacing it with a totally pliant one.
So again, to be clear, and then I'll hand this over to Noah, your argument is that we can't win because Russia wants it more, and it's more in Russia's national interest to do this than it is in ours to stop them, but that in the long run, Russia won't benefit from it, and it will prove to have been a folly. Is that right?
Something along those terms. I mean, and again, this is not something unknown to history. I mean, it would have been folly for, again, like analogies that maybe we're more familiar with. It would have been folly for Irish nationalists to try to win over the six counties of Northern Ireland, given the militarization of the Protestant population there. But I would not call the subsequent 100-year history of Northern Ireland a smashing success. So this is, you know, two powers can meet in a war and both decline afterward. I mean, look to the UK after World War II. It won and then lost its empire.
Well, the United States helped Britain in World War II because they were being bombed and would have been invaded, irrespective of what they did to British power. But let's go to Noah. Noah, start your argument from the ground up or address Michael's, however you see fit.
I'll do it all, and I'll do it all in 5 to 7 minutes, I hope. So we're going with our priors, what we take into this debate. And I'm going to take it all the way back to 1991. It's my first political memory, really, is coming downstairs in August of 91 and seeing my parents glued to the television, watching the coup unfold in Moscow and seeing in their faces an expression I had not seen before, which was mortal terror. Michael said in the introduction that we were not in imminent danger, I believe the words he used, during the Cold War because of Moscow's possessions and what we used to call the captive nations. That's revisionist, because we all know how it turned out. It's not how it felt at the time. And I took those priors with me when I was getting a graduate degree in international relations in the post-Soviet space in 2008-2010, which was right around the time when Moscow began exerting its intention to recapture what it calls the near abroad term of art for the post-Soviet space, and in some places, the Warsaw Pact. And this seemed obvious to me that Moscow's objectives were not just the reconstitution of something resembling the Soviet empire, but the pursuit of an objective that it had executed throughout the Soviet period and in the Russian period, which is the X-telegram, essentially, that breaking Western power, breaking its alliances, is one of Russia's grand strategic objectives. And this was when I advocated something like this to my professors at the time. They looked at me like I was crazy, because it was obvious to them that the only reason Moscow invaded Georgia in 2008, which, by the way, happened 4 months after the Bucharest summit that Michael mentioned, that was April 2008 when the MAP ascension plans for Georgia and Ukraine stalled. And 4 months later, Moscow took the cue and invaded Georgia. And I said, we obviously need a containment plan for Russia. And they looked at me like I was crazy because it was obvious to them that the only reason why Moscow was acting out is because of George W. Bush's cowboy diplomacy. This was in contravention of all the international theory we had been learning, but it was obvious to them, and it was a form of chauvinism, a kind of chauvinism that views the United States as the author and arbiter of all events abroad, good and bad. Used to hear that from progressives a lot. Now I hear it from the right increasingly. And it's very much central to Russia's war in Ukraine. Russia's war in Ukraine didn't begin in 2022. It didn't even begin in 2014, which, by the way, was the same year Moscow executed a brazen cross-border raid in Estonia using radar jamming technology and smoke grenades. And they sent some advisors across the border, captured a border guard, brought him home to Moscow, and put him on trial. Moscow doesn't recognize the bright red line of NATO's borders like we want them to. But that effort to undermine Ukraine began in roughly 2004, 2005 with the Orange Revolution. Not only did Moscow execute covert operations and energy blackmail in Ukraine, they executed it across Europe and targeted Europe with these tactics. The divisions that we observe between NATO's borders and Ukraine's borders are not as well observed by Moscow, just point of fact. We also talk a lot about the unachievability of Ukraine's war aims, and we should be focusing quite a bit more on Russia's war aims, which have not changed publicly or based on what we see in open source intelligence, which is the capture and subsumation of most of Ukraine into the Russian Federation, if not all of it, and if not all of it, leaving behind a truncated rump state, which will most likely be something close to a failed state, the host possibly to an insurgency, which, by the way, was the Biden administration's plan going into this war. As Michael said, nobody thought they could win. And the plan, you could go look this up in the New York Times, was to say, open up the weapons stocks and let everybody have weapons and just go at the Russians. And I guarantee you that is what would occur in a Russian occupation. And the notion here that that's acceptable is predicated on our oceans. It is not acceptable to NATO's allies, to the NATO allies on the frontier. And the likelihood that you have Russian forces advancing rapidly towards NATO's borders or a failed state in Ukraine would make countries like Romania and Bulgaria and Poland and the Baltic states and even Hungary very fearful for their borders and introduce the prospect of much more volatility and even a conflagration, because they would have to go their own way if the United States were to maintain our prima inter pares, our supremacy of the alliance, and try to guide these states. That we would experience quite a bit of resistance from the border states, who may feel obliged to introduce troops on the ground just to protect their own borders. That's something we should seek to avoid. And the way to avoid it is to take this manageable crisis and manage it. The big fear, from my perspective, is not that Russia will execute some kind of fold-the-gap style invasion of NATO states. It doesn't have that capacity. And it doesn't need to, frankly. What it would do, and what my biggest fear is, that it engineers a crisis in the Swalski Gap or in Estonia that compels a NATO state to introduce Article 5. And Article 5 will be exposed as hollow because it won't be observed. That would render the alliance a paper tiger. And without a shot being fired, undermine, if not destroy, the integrity of the Atlantic Alliance proper. The chances that NATO forces would intervene on the ground in Ukraine seem to me more likely in the event of a Ukrainian collapse and a retrograde operation than if we manage this crisis in its current terms. And the argument then becomes, well, we can't risk losing, so we have to lose earlier, because otherwise we'll have a bigger loss on our hands. And that just strikes me as unstrategic and, for lack of a better word, slightly craven, because we do have profound interest in maintaining the alliance structure. We do have an interest in containing this crisis insofar as it's containable, manage it while it is manageable. And the prospect of having to spend more money on this, which some people object to, or devote political capital and diplomatic capital to maintaining what has been Europe's focus on this war, admirable focus on this war, I think is a small price to pay compared to the price that we would have to pay in the event of failure, which could very well be unbearable.
All right, let me ask you both in turn the same question. I'll start with Michael. Michael, Russia invaded Ukraine. That happened. That wasn't theoretical. It wasn't brought about by rhetoric or bellicose papers out of Washington, D.C. It actually happened. Actual troops went in. And
have I somewhere disputed
no,
this?
No, I'm just setting the scene here.
I'm just wondering, because this is like you telling me water is wet. It is so condescending.
No, but it's important. I'm like shocked. It's important to explain this because we have.
How is it important to explain the fact we all acknowledge?
Because very often this debate ranges onto separate topics, such as America's approach towards Russia or Ukraine, or the idea that the United States is interested in turning Ukraine into a vassal state in the long run. I just want to ask this question in this way to make it evident that that is the question and not something else. So in goes Russia. Okay. They actually go in. What should the United States have done at that point about those people and arms in Ukraine in Russian uniforms?
Nothing. I mean, you know, we could send humanitarian aid, rally everyone else, except refugees, etc. But I think Ukraine is ultimately, in the longest run, better served fighting its own fight rather than being seen as a potential staging ground for NATO with a NATO interoperable military force. Small countries have been able to defend themselves and establish their independence through their own tactics. It, of course, they would prefer heavy weaponry from the West. Not everyone gets that, and not every war is won by superiority in heavy weaponry. We had superiority in heavy weaponry in Afghanistan for 20 years. We turned it back over to the Taliban.
Can I ask a question, Charlie, briefly, of Michael's position? So, yeah, sure, Michael, sure. We've had this argument over lethal arms for Ukraine for a decade. Was it your view in the Obama years that the Republicans who were lobbying for lethal aid that Obama balked at were wrong, and that when they convinced Trump to reverse that policy, that they were also wrong?
Yeah, I've always advocated against us providing this stuff because it would always look like NATO membership by de facto rather than de jure, and would set off the red line, which, by the way, everyone acknowledges this is not just Putin's red line. This is a red line that we have heard from Russia for decades, from liberals that we supported in Russia, like Yegor Gregor, to everyone else. That there's not a conceivable Russian leader who would accept NATO membership of Ukraine without some kind of fight put up. And we set it up. We set this up for the worst possible outcome for Ukraine with this weird declaration that it will happen in the future. And in these gaps, these gaps in politics where you announce some outcome that you can't affect for years are always strategically stupid because they allow the opponents of that settlement time and space to act in and use extraordinary means to stop it.
So I take an alternative view to that, although it's sort of a cousin of that view, is that when the map, the accession process stalled in Bucharest in 2008, that Moscow had a window of opportunity to act, and that had our accession process been more firm, like, say, Montenegro or North Macedonia, that it would have prevented Moscow from taking more egregious action. By backing off, we created the space for Russia to say, well, there'll be no consequences for military action. And it did so at times and places of its choosing, not immediately thereafter, but certainly because we demonstrated that we didn't have the will to act in concert with our intentions, that it provided Moscow with reasonable assurances that it could get away with land grabs.
So, Noah, what would you have done? What should we have done?
So, in retrospect, I was probably wrong to believe that the decision to stall Ukraine and Georgia's accession to NATO was right. It was predicated on assumptions about the military posture that were unequal to NATO membership and corruption inside these respective nations that didn't meet the standards of the North Atlantic Council. And that seemed all well and good to me, procedural, and to which I deferred to. Had the accession taken place, I don't think Moscow would have attacked Ukraine or Georgia. So would we be dealing with problems because of their accession? Yeah. Would they be worse than the problems we're dealing with today? I find it hard to see.
See, I have a problem with this view because I think the political problem inside Ukraine was really intractable. This is not a fit candidate for NATO in 2008. It was not a fit candidate for NATO in 2022. you had a political culture there. You had Poroshenko before Zelensky, who ran as a hard nationalist, who ran as, we're getting away from Russia, we're aspiring towards NATO and the EU. He was rejected for Zelensky.
How did Zelensky run for office?
Party of the regions.
He ran for office on a platform of rapprochement with Russia.
Right.
People like me were like, "Whoa, Zelensky's not a good dude. he's had way too many overtures to Moscow."
But he had popular support precisely because he was not associated pro or con with the Maidan revolution. So you still had a huge democratic element of Ukrainian society that was not dead set on westernization.
And Michael, something you said in your answer fascinated me. You said that we should do nothing, we should have done nothing. And then you said you think Ukraine would be in a better position or better off as a result of that. That's a different argument than American interest. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that the involvement of NATO raises the stakes unbelievably for Russia, at least in their mind. And in just the same way that if in, you know, the dismemberment of the British Empire, the United States started militarily intervening on behalf of the revolutionaries throwing off the British yoke, it would have raised the stakes for the United Kingdom immeasurably and led to a much more severe response. This isn't just hanging up the phone about the Suez crisis, but should we begin taking shots at their navy?
So we've made it worse for Ukraine by giving them money and arms.
We have made it worse for Ukraine in the way that John Mearsheimer predicted years ago, by leading them down a path where they thought they would get protection that ultimately we cannot provide for them, and we haven't provided for them, and leading them to a situation where they were vulnerable to this invasion and the country is wrecked. I mean, we should not have gone down this process. In this, Noah and I are actually close to agreement. We just come at it from a slightly different angle. Now, I want to address just a couple things Noah said.
You're moving away again, aren't you? I'm asking, once they were invaded, you think we made it worse by getting involved? Forget what happened before that.
Well, we were already heavily involved by this point, having raised up in 6 years the largest land army in Europe after Russia's. Basically, we funded it entirely. This is what Putin, I guess, decided was unacceptable to have along his border and precipitated the invasion.
I mean, Michael, I don't want to interrupt you because you did want to respond to some things I want to say, but I do want to address that briefly in terms of American national interests and the notion that we, as a hegemonic power, can somehow divorce ourselves from places where we have profound interests, like the Levant in the Middle East and like the European continent, where we've been dragged into every conflict that really conflagrates on that continent because we have immutable grand strategic interests there. We did the same thing in Syria in an effort to try to extricate ourselves from that conflict, indeed leaning on Russia to try to get us out of that conflict with this notion that Moscow would eliminate all the chemical weapons in stockpiles in Damascus, which is obviously false, but it was an effort to extricate ourselves from our national interests, and gravity, just the political gravity of it, draws us back in, which is why it's foolish to wait for the conditions that are worse than prevail today to address these crises in parts of the world where we have interests that aren't going to go away. We can't just write them out of the map.
But here's where I'd like to probe you on a couple of things. And I'll circle right back to that point in a few bullet points. You pointed out that it's not how it felt at the time during the Cold War, that we weren't under threat from, you know, Kremlin domination of capitals like Kiev, that this is a revisionist view. I'm willing to accept that, but then critics of Ukraine, critics, the pro-Ukraine side, should stop referring to the post-World War II order as the one they're preserving.
Yes.
They're about preserving the 1991 to 2006 order?
Yes, the post-Cold War order. Post-war order in Europe means something very specific. But the post Cold War order is.
So I would like the post World War II order dropped, because that order, which I agree we triumphed in, was one where we suffered setbacks and tolerated setbacks to avoid worse wars. We saw the Red Army crash into Budapest in 56. Ike did not intervene. People wanted him to intervene. We saw the way the Russians put down Solidarity in Poland in 1981, and neoconservative commentators accused Reagan of using that chance to stabilize the Soviet Empire rather than confront it. So this world order was durable enough to handle setbacks. You mentioned that in your response that you think not acting now to head off the threat will lead to a worse situation later for us. This is a point on which we do disagree, but I want to probe you. So what limits do you recognize on America's ability to intervene in Ukraine?
Well, the whole point...
Are you waiting for an outrage that will move public opinion in favor of NATO troops?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question, Noah. I'd like to know that too. What is the outer limit of our support, either on a military basis or financially?
Yeah, we've had this conversation before previously on the editors. The whole point of my advocacy and advocacy of others who want us to support Ukraine to the hilt, to the degree that it can contain the threat and roll it back even as far away from NATO borders as possible, is to ensure that NATO forces are never in a position where they have to engage Russian forces directly, or even in a Syria-like scenario where we have assets positioned in the same threat environment and we're all shooting at each other's proxies. Very, very dangerous. Don't want that to happen. The idea, the strategy, the tactics are to provide Ukraine with the capacity to roll back Russian troops and prevent them from advancing any further at the very least. The strategy is to keep Russian forces as far away from NATO borders with a hot conflict as possible. So the limit, the outer limit, is NATO forces anywhere near a hot conflict zone with Russia. And the outer limit of financial support, I suppose, is, I don't know, we'd have to get there for me to see it. But right now, 2% of our defense budget doesn't even remotely approach the outer limits of our financial contributions to what is a core national U.S. interest containing an aggressive and expansionist Russia.
So I agree with you that it was dangerous in Syria. However, I don't agree that it would have been worth a policy of regime change in Syria, which Russia would have perceived as, yet again, another attempt to deprive them of a major naval asset, this one in the Mediterranean.
Right, but that's even, I mean, yes, sure, the port at Tartus we could talk about, but the port at Sevastopol is a red herring. I don't like the port at Sevastopol talk. That's a red herring. The lease was active until the 2040s, when Zelensky inherited. There was no threat to the lease. They had access to the port at Sevastopol for as long as they wanted, and the notion that it was under some sort of threat, and that's so they had to invade in 2014, in order to secure all of Crimea, is just, that's just face saving.
So would they have kept the lease if Ukraine had joined NATO?
There was no threat to the lease, and there's no NATO accession plan. The accession plan stalled out in Bucharest in 2008, never to be revived.
But in your alternate history, you would have preferred that Ukraine join NATO in 2008.
In retrospect, knowing what I know now, at the time I didn't. And I certainly don't see NATO's accession. NATO shouldn't inherit this active hot conflict with Russia, obviously.
Okay, but wouldn't how I just don't understand how to resolve this view that you wish we could have effected NATO membership for Ukraine earlier, but that the Russian lease in Sevastopol was never under threat. Doesn't the membership in NATO implies ejecting them from Sevastopol?
It's certainly not in 2008 by any means. This is at the time when we were still under the delusion that Russia was a natural ally in the war on terror because of Beslan and the Nordost siege.
I don't think that's true exactly because of what happened in Georgia. And again, we disagree there about exactly what happened. It was after Bucharest. I've personally spoke with Stephen Hadley about this, George Bush's security advisor. He recalled to me that President Bush stuck his finger in Saakashvili's chest, the president of Georgia, and said, "Do not poke the bear. We will not save you." And OSCE concluded that Georgia escalated first.
So Georgia deserved to be invaded and carved up too?
What?
So Georgia deserved to be invaded and carved up as well?
So do you? So
yeah, I just asked you a question.
Russia should not have. Russia should not have responded.
That wasn't a rhetorical question, Michael.
To an indiscriminate artillery barrage. I just don't understand. Like we're stipulating that Putin is a bad guy, but then we're also stipulating that he should behave nicely after an artillery barrage on his forces. I find that a little bit hard to process.
All right, let me ask a question that came up on the editors but didn't get too much discussion. Why do you think, Michael, that we are so assiduously funding Ukraine? Do you think it's part of some broader strategy that you oppose? Do you think it is weak-willed saccharine desire to make ourselves feel good?
There's a couple of ways to look at it. I mean, listen, there is some portion of opinion is broadly aligned with what Noah has articulated, which is this idea that if we allow Russia to triumph in this country that we had not extended a security guarantee to before, but if we allow that, then we are in a very perilous situation. Putin will go from strength to strength somehow and work himself up towards a direct confrontation with NATO, or maybe, as Noah says, a more indirect one to try to break its alliance. Again, I'm not sure how that works exactly. I mean, the incursion into Estonia didn't break Article 5.
Because it was never invoked.
Right.
Never has been invoked, save after 9/11. The closest we came was when a Turkish jet was shot down by a Russian fighter, again, because of Russia's intervention in Syria militarily, unilaterally. And we talked Turkey out of going from Article 4 to Article 5.
Right.
And that's what I fear would happen in this scenario, too, is that the United States and the Western powers would gather and say, listen, you can go to Article 4, but you can't go to Article 5. You're going to have to accept this Russian incursion, however small it might be, at which point we have a die for Danzig moment, and the alliance, however, it might be retained, but it will be a paper tiger. The mutual defense provisions will be not worth the paper they're written on.
I don't think it is a paper tiger. Once you're willing to fight and you have a combined arms force like you have in Poland that's trained, and we have Russia, which has not shown a very strong ability to use combined forces besides this attack helicopter strategy that they've adopted along their lines in Ukraine.
Ukraine does have better advantages. I don't want to interrupt there, but NATO tactics and having a non-commissioned officer corps that can make decisions on the ground is a strategic advantage that Russia cannot emulate. Russia's tactics are very much top-down.
Correct. And Putin has seemed to acknowledge that a direct confrontation with NATO threatens life on this planet. That is a totally different kettle of fish for him, and has had to assert over and over again he does not have immediate designs on Poland. I don't think he should, because I frankly don't think swallowing... I don't think even if he manages to swallow Luhansk and Donetsk, the appetite is going to be there for another decade or two as they try to recover from what they've expended in this war. And when they won't have achieved, I believe, all of their goals in it. I do not expect, I mean, my assumption is, given the number of troops sent and given how they've performed, now I know they've performed against American weapons, so I can't run that counterfactual. I just don't believe that Russia has the ability to swallow Western Ukraine.
So, Michael, let's look at this the other way around. If this is not in America's interest, if we should have just sat and watched as Russia invaded Ukraine because they're not a threat to Poland or the rest of Europe or another NATO ally, and therefore, although it's sad, we should have said, what is in America's interest? Where would an invasion like this be worth our sending money at the least, or people at the worst?
I think where it seriously threatens America's core security and prosperity. So I would point to, and this is a bullet I think Noah hinted at wanting to make me swallow at the end of the editor's podcast. And here, before everyone, I will swallow it. I actually don't think it's Taiwan. Elbridge Colby's book, which I think is very good, is actually the least persuasive on America defending Taiwan, but very persuasive that the island chain around it, Japan, and so on, is the crucial theater, and what we need is South Korea and Japan to continue being our allies and fight if China wants to try to break out and establish some kind of hegemony in Asia. Now, I personally believe we need a military buildup to try to avoid that scenario for China. And actually, against my own slightly mercantilist politics, I actually think we should abandon the restrictive parts of the CHIPS Act on China's ability to manufacture chips, precisely to give Xi the impression that he does not have to slay the American dragon in order to achieve China's peaceful rise.
So I appreciate the honesty there. I certainly don't share that objective. I think one of America's core interests, grand strategic interests, is the prevention of the establishment of pre-World War II, inviolable spheres of influence in which navigation is throttled, commerce is inaccessible. It will make the world less safe. It will compel us to forward position U.S. troops to satisfy our allies who are threatened by aggressive expansionist powers abroad. It will make our lives less comfortable and much more expensive, and it will force us to be more extroverted on the world stage, not less.
So you think Taiwan would be navigation of the seas would go?
Well, certainly the Taiwan Strait would be unnavigable, and much of the South China Sea, I suspect, would be unnavigable. And the amount of commerce that flows through there is just indescribable.
No, I agree. The amount of commerce. I'm just not convinced that the seas can be done. And I'm also not sure that a real battle over Taiwan would leave anything economically viable on Taiwan, which I think should deter everyone from wanting to go in.
Let me invert the question for you. What is not in our interest? What would you be prepared to look at in the world and say, that's just not America's business, leave it alone?
Well, we can actually look at a concrete example of that, which in my view, was the intervention in Libya. Europe has a lot of interests in North Africa. The United States does not. In fact, there are plenty of places on the planet Earth where our only interest is making sure that we have no interests. I would say sub-Saharan Africa is among those, to a lesser degree, most of South America, with the exception of a lot of Central America, insofar as it relates to domestic security and crime and the border. But beyond that, it is in our interest to ensure that we have stable countries there, passive relationships with countries there, and perhaps even forward deployments, but only to ensure that we don't have a broader footprint or need a broader footprint in the future. It's a proactive approach, not because we have super concrete interests there, but because if we were to sacrifice, allow a conflict to metastasize, we very soon might find that we did. That's also the story of Libya to a certain extent, but it was about maintaining alliance structure. And the reason why we led from behind there, as it were, is because the alliance was going to go with or without us, or our allies were going to go with or without us. And it was imperative for us to maintain the prima inter pares role and support our allies in their pursuit of their own domestic security, because it's a two-way street there. That's how alliance structure works. So if you were to say, what parts of the world shouldn't we intervene in, I would say those where we don't have American interests, and insofar as we can preserve stability in those countries that border where we have American interests, that's a key objective, but it is valuable and desirable to question what interests are at stake, where we have concrete interests and where we do not. And I think those regions, definitely, we have fewer interests than we do in places like East Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. Those places draw us into those conflicts, whether we want to be in them or not. And that's because we have core national interests and alliance interests that are just not something we can choose to observe. We will observe them whether we want to or not.
Just curious, what do you make of potential U.S. withdrawal from Niger and potential Russian entry in?
I mean, in the zero-sum game of geopolitics, that's a source of frustration and consternation, but it's not an immediate threat. What is an immediate threat is the lack of our ability to continue counterterrorism operations with the support of a friendly government there. That could end up becoming something that we will regret down the road. But that's a different question than geopolitics vis-a-vis our near-peer competitors.
All right. Last question for both of you. What would it take you to change your view on this? So, Michael, you keep saying you don't think Putin can conquer Western Ukraine. If he did, would you change your mind? And if not, what would it take?
I'd have to revise my assumptions, but and I would be clearly wrong if there was some kind of unprovoked attack, serious attack on NATO that would obviously require military redress. I'm not talking about like incursion into airspace or these kind of annoyances that don't, you know, that don't really affect people's prosperity or their security. Yeah, I
mean, would it not alarm you if he went into Western Ukraine and conquered it and was that close to Poland, even if he didn't have immediate plans to invade it? Noah brings up this threat of just being in the vicinity where you could find your side and a NATO ally shooting at each other.
I understand, but again, like, NATO expansionists have wanted to add the 900 miles of Finland's border, and they wanted to add Ukraine's border to radically expand and be right up next to Russia by 1,900 extra miles to defend.
I'm highly confident Finland can police its 900 mile border with Russia. They've demonstrated the capacity to do so.
They did lose territory in World War II, even though they put up the awesome fight, and they have the supreme honor of World War II of fighting both the bad guys in that war.
I take that point. Is there not a difference, though, between us?
I agree. I mean, obviously there's a difference between us expanding and Russia expanding and Russian expansionism, but we have dealt with much more intimate and managed much more intimate close encounters between Russia and the West than before, and Russia is fantastically weaker compared to the West than it was during the Cold War, where we were the ones, you know, using nuclear brinksmanship to even out a strategy where their armed forces were much more large and threatening. Noah, do you ever worry about the alliance structure itself, in that alliance structures like this, you know, whether you call it chain ganging or whatever, they allow small nations like Estonia to be much more provocative with their neighbors than they otherwise would be because they have the protection of the United States, meanwhile limiting the United States' own foreign policy and freezing it as anti-Russian in perpetuity. Whereas, you know, in the Cold War, we found it pretty advantageous at one point to try to split the communist bloc.
Our alliances do not lead us to a policy that is anti-Russian. We have a policy of anti-Russian because every president in this century has entered office saying, I can reset relations with Russia. And every president has been proven wrong because Russia draws its own interests diametrically opposed to the United States and pursues them aggressively. The distinction between NATO and Russia, obviously, is that NATO members ascend to membership when its legislature votes on membership and all the other 30-some-odd democratic states similarly vote and allow it in. The Russian conception of expansion is by gunpoint. It's a big difference. I am kept up at night by the prospect that our alliances on the Russian frontier will get really antsy with their exposure and take risks and freelance and do things to protect themselves that imperil the alliance broadly. I'm very terrified of that, frankly. That's why it's imperative on us to engage and to play the prima inter pares role and to coordinate all the 30-some-odd states into one strategic approach to containing the Russian threat, because the alternative is to cede that role and get all the member states in the alliance really head up about what their own particular interests are. Some in Western Europe, maybe not Macron's government, some in Western Europe will adopt a more passive posture. I would be 100% sure that the Baltic states, and Poland in particular, would be much more aggressive because they would be much more freaked out And the Baltic states would be profoundly threatened in the event that Russia were to advance much further, because resupplying the Baltics through the tiny Suwalski Gap in Poland would be an unviable proposition just by virtue of the position of Russian artillery so close to that area. These states would fear their subsumation to something resembling a Russian imperium with real reason to do so. And they would act in their own defense, whether we like it or not. So yes, that does concern me greatly, which is why proactivity on our part is far more advantageous than passivity.
Okay, so just to clarify the beginning of that answer, so you believe Russian-American hostility is perpetual and eternal, and there are no political circumstances in which we might want to try to split them from China as we previously split China from them.
The Sino-Soviet split had everything to do with the Chinese and Russian communist governments. And the Vietnam War has very little bearing on today's circumstances. Certainly, the fact that China is Russia's foremost purchaser of its oil and its energy exports mutes that prospect. The notion here that there's some like a Vivek Ramaswamy style grand bargain where we can somehow cleave off this relationship as though, A, that would be something that's possible, and B, if they said they were going to do it, would be something they've observed. Or would be observed, seems to me very naive.
Well, I'm just saying, if the anti-hegemonic coalition, you know, is what we fear, I'm just curious if you're open to the idea of trying to split Russia off from that. But
we've been trying. This is the whole point of these exercises by Presidents Bush through Biden, to sit down across from Russia and try to talk them out of their national interests. Until Moscow doesn't define its national interest as breaking Western power, as becoming once again equal to Western power by breaking its hold over Eastern Europe and shattering the alliance broadly, setting these countries against themselves, then no, our interests will be opposed.
Noah, what would it take for you to change your mind, shift your worldview?
In what sense? Can you elaborate specifically or sort of 30,000 foot?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps Michael suggested that NATO members might start saber-rattling and you change your view of alliances or the value of the post-1991 status quo, or maybe 10 years pass and Putin has Western Ukraine but doesn't do anything with it, or perhaps the American economy enters into a debt crisis and we say, wow, it wasn't the primary driver of it, but we sure spent a lot of money for nothing. I'm just interested.
I mean, these are a lot of hypotheticals, and perhaps it's a failure of imagination on my part. I'm sure it is. But just based on the litany you laid out, no, I can't see myself backing off my view that American hegemony is desirable, because anything that comes after it will be less desirable. And challenges to American hegemony anywhere are by definition challenges to it everywhere. We have seen a proto-alliance forming in the anti-American powers, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. They're very open about it. Their coordination is out in the open, military and economic, and the constellation of terrorist groups that surround them are active in executing kinetic operations against Western forces and Western powers. They all have the same goal, and that goal is to usher in a world that I think would be far worse than the one that we've lived in since 1991. I think American hegemony is profoundly valuable, not just for Americans, but the world broadly, and we should defend it.
I agree with Noah. Maybe this is a good place to end. But I agree with Noah that American hegemony is valuable, and it sustains our otherwise unsustainable standard of living, for one, which again undergirds our political stability, too. So on that, I agree. I fear squandering this in unnecessary wars of choice, as many other empires have fallen before them by engaging in those. And I would say that I think the American order-led order is durable, even and can endure some setbacks without entirely the logic of it entirely collapsing. And I think we proved this during the Cold War, in which we did suffer real setbacks, but we pressed our advantages, and we have advantages. One, we're attractive in a way that the Chinese and Russian systems cannot be. and we are much more prosperous, and we will continue to be more prosperous than those systems can be. And I think our prospects in the long run are very good. I think Russian and Chinese demographics are very poor for their long-term geopolitical prospects. And I think avoiding what would otherwise be a terribly risky major wars among the major powers is our number one strategy for thriving and surviving in the next century. And that is why I don't want the United States to conflate the credibility of its self-defense with Ukraine's defense. I think that's just preposterous, and that is not actually how credibility works.
So I agree mostly. We are attractive insofar as we're a democratic consensual alliance, and the alternatives are predicated on hard power and the application of it. But there is a theory postulated by Stephen Walt, among others, that these member states, the allied states, partner states that are in these regions that are frontline partners, they balance right now against the bully in their neighborhood. But if the balancing act isn't satisfying or leaves them exposed, they could just as easily bandwagon with the bully in their neighborhood and, without a shot being fired, create the spheres of influence that will have a deleterious effect on our way of life and our defense posture.
Right. And to that, I would only say is we can only sustain what the American people will pay for in blood and treasure. And I do think our alliance structure as it is today is strained severely against that measurement, that for all the grand ideas of our planners, all of the people that want to advise the executive branch and win the glory of being, you know, the vizier to the great hegemonic power, and they have to contend with limits that are set democratically by our people's willingness to fight. And that, you know, we, after World War II, and there's a little disagreement with Noah, yes, we do have a consensual alliance system, but it was established with tremendous violence in World War II. And it's sustained at its edges by the threat of tremendous violence. And we'll be reminded of that very shortly by when Donald Trump gets on the microphone again and starts talking about Iran or his big button in North Korea. So that the willingness to inflict that violence and endure what it brings back is our real limit, and we have to pay attention to them. And again, I think they limit what we can do in Ukraine, which is just at the far edges of Europe. I mean, again, my hope is that Europe takes this time to increase its own strength. We're seeing it in Poland. We're seeing it in the Baltics. I am worried about the new entrance into NATO, that they are making one-term commitments and then hoping to free ride into retirement. But we're seeing Poland step up. I actually would like to see Germany and France, Italy, and the United Kingdom step up even more.
If I am allowed the pleasure of indulging my solipsism, there is a value to allowing Europe to free ride, because I kind of like the conception of an alliance that keeps Germany down and a lot of these countries that have a lot of fractious relationships with their neighbors, not armed to the teeth and looking at each other hungrily. The alliance has been very beneficial insofar as it has muted European, intra-European, intra-democratic frustrations and the prospect of conflict there. Again, it's, you know, it seems hard to imagine, but again, let's try to avoid failures of imagination.
What? No.
It's the longest time in history we've had a unified Germany that hasn't started a war.
I take the point, but I don't know. I prefer the Cold War era Germany with a Wehrmacht that would actually do some damage rather than the post-Merkel one where we have a basically piddling thing where their tanks don't even work for parades. I'm not sure that that's good for America. I mean, that's basically putting it out there that this is an alliance of all debits that all men have to bleed for.
I am, because I gave Michael the first word, I'm going to invite Noah to say anything in conclusion that he wants to. And then I'm going to channel Rich, and I'm going to shut this one down too, because we have gone for an hour, which I think is a perfect amount of time.
It is. I think most of everything that needs to be said was said here. The project in which the Western world has engaged since the February 22 invasion is one that we should have engaged in 2014, we allowed this crisis to metastasize, to become the biggest conflagration on the European continent since 1945, typified by some of the worst human rights abuses we have seen since a similar period. And it is all a part of our desire to avoid conflict. Contrary to Michael's outlook, I see a Western world that is allergic to conflict, particularly with peer competitors and great powers, that does everything within its power to avoid confronting these forces until the point at which confrontation becomes inevitable, and it is no longer then at a time and place of our choosing. We have summoned a fair amount of resolve that sends a valuable signal abroad, but I'm terrified of the prospect of the signals that we're sending in terms of resolve go the other direction and communicate to all the other irredentist states, all the revisionist countries on the planet Earth, that they have the United States will do what it's done for the last 70 years, which is get tired after a couple of years and go home and sacrifice its allies and give up on its commitments because it's just too hard. And a lot of people get very frustrated with it. And we gradually see the profound gift that we were bequeathed by our fathers and grandfathers who fought for it just ebb away because we get a little too uneasy with the maintenance that is necessary to preserve the glorious world order that is led by the United States and its hard power. I think that is a profound gift. I want to bequeath it to my children. I think it requires preservation and active support. And to the extent that we are limiting Moscow's capacity to project power abroad and menace its neighbors, and therefore force us to make even bigger, broader commitments to national security in Europe and as well as the Pacific. They are theaters of conflict that are linked in certain ways. At least they are linked in the view of Seoul and Tokyo and Taipei. Then I think this is a crucial project. And if we fail at it, I suspect that failure will compound in ways that we will profoundly regret.
All right. Thanks to both of you. And I imagine we'll do this again next time we're on The Editors.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
And that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you to Michael, Brendan Doughty, and Noah for coming on and continuing their argument. Thank you to our sponsor, which is CEI's Free the Economy podcast. Thank you to you for listening. And we'll see you next time.